Welcome to Holden Village and the Holden Theological Conference, sponsored by the Lutheran Education Network and support. Today is Tuesday, September the 26th. This evening in the Fireside Room, we're going to be listening to a fireside chat with Bruce Hartung. Let's listen in.
This is purely a kind of discussion session, so it starts when you ask questions. So who wants to start the ball rolling in terms of any kinds of questions or further elaborations that you'd like Dr. Hartung to make?
And is the expectation that I answer them then when they're asked?
Yeah, that's the expectation.
Thank you. I say the level of anxiety is going up.
So who wants to open the discussion?
I'll try back here. Bruce, we heard Dr. Lowell speak yesterday about an affirmative way of keeping your mouth shut. We also hear you about saying and giving voice to our feelings. Do you care to compare or contrast any of those, that encouragement?
No. I think that there is a sense in which it's possible that people may believe that there's too much talk, and I think in some cases stuff can tilt into that every prick, every pain becomes magnified. My assumption, following Luther's explanation of the Eighth Commandment, of sort of reframing what he was saying, would be that that's what he was talking in relationship to, sort of the over exaggeration, which does move into a pathology. If, however, he was going back to my growing up, which is essentially was don't tell or tough it out, I think that's part of the suppressive repressive culture that sometimes becomes pietized or given theological overtones. And I think that is not a good thing. So I don't think that the counter business to keep quiet, too many people have kept quiet for too long, and the whole point of being able to have voices that emerge to speak of their experience is just crucial. And to turn back on that, to silence voices when it hasn't become a pathological problem, you know, I would disagree with him if that were where he was going. My sense of it was that was not, at least I hope, that wasn't it. But what did you hear? Maybe.
Well, that's helpful. I'm probably one that has been raised more in the repressive and maybe borderline denial. Tough it out. Hearing your words as carefully as you can and encourage them that way.
One of the things that we've got is the rising, beginning research. Some of you probably know this, but there's all this new stuff emerging in the research field in an area that I can hardly pronounce and I practice a lot. It's called psychoneuroimmunology. It's the business of what happens to our immune system, and that there are certain kinds of things that appear to suppress the immune system or to work on suppressing the immune system, and that this may have some of the issues related to how come we get sick, and that a suppressive repressive culture tends to suppress the immune system. Because we're using energy, first of all, it distances people, reduces empathic contact, and people are left to manage their own internal states by themselves. It takes a tremendous amount of energy, and if you something about the old sort of energy model is that you just don't, then that whole process simply puts the brakes on one's whole physiological apparatus, because what you're trying to do is shut down stuff in yourself, and you just can't, it's very hard to selectively shut down. So when you begin to shut down feelings or emotionality, you're shutting down other processes And if that's combined with empathic breaks with people, then you're doing that sort of in an isolated sense. And that then creates more distance and hostile relationships, which also apparently has a difficult has some difficulty with the immune system as well. It seems also, conversely, that people in warm relationships that feel supported, that actually strengthens the immune system. And whatever the kinds of things are in terms of the elevation of whatever it is that shows that stuff is working well. I mean, they're beginning to demonstrate that certain kinds of conditions produce certain kinds of physiological results that are directly related to disease, not only just diseases of emotion, but also diseases of physiology. So the thing is then, well, how do we create empathic relationships that have some depth to them? That has a net effect of strengthening the immune system. Well, you don't do that by not saying what's going on. Because the more secrets there are, the less empathy there's going to be with our experience. But, I mean, I don't know. I grew up, I mean, it was tough it out, folks. Sort of shut up and go forward. I think a lot of us learn that, and I think that's not... If you begin to think about what constitutes health and begin to move away from the idea that health is an individual notion and it's a group notion, that the unit of health is corporate rather than individual, then the nature of health is contained in healthy relationships. That it's not just having people exercise, it's families that value that. It's not just single people putting on seat belts, but a culture that values that. It's not just, I mean, what's the greatest threat to people's health? I mean, it depends on where you are. If you were in Sarajevo, the greatest threat to your health would be an incoming missile, not a germ. If you're 18 to 25 and a Caucasian male, the greatest threat to your health is going to be somebody coming at you in a car who's been drinking, or you riding in one, because the unintentional injury business tends to be that. Well, those are all corporate issues and lifestyle issues, not individual, how do I take care of my germ issues. So anyway, that's a sort of a longer answer. Is that what you want me to do? Is I just sort of blather on like this, John?
I was going to, when you were talking this evening, I was reminded of the experiences that I had as a pastor in the old central district of the old ALC, which goes back into the 40s and 50s. And I can remember that clergy at synod conventions or district conventions would have very strenuous and dialogue and very aggressive disagreements among each other as they were discussing on the convention floor. But when it came time for the communion service, those persons who had these violent disagreements would find each other out, shake hands before going to communion. Now there was a healing function in that process. And what I'm wondering is what existed in that culture to make that possible, which today doesn't happen.
Maybe some people have some ideas. My own guess is it's the empathic link to each other in the relationship. That is, the relationship of people in the body of Christ becomes a primary motivator. So I can be, that my early comments about cynicism, cynical people don't change things, they just switch. So if I disagree with you and there's not a relationship holding us together or an empathic link, I simply leave my relationship with you. It doesn't matter. That kind of stuff suppresses the immune system and puts pressure on all people who try to serve people. It would seem to me that the kind of thing that you're describing is one, I'm just sort of projecting what I think on it, is that that's one in which people held the relationship to be a very important piece. And so they could do all kinds of other things, but when push came to shove, the empathic connection, the relationship endured, and people wanted to find ways to demonstrate that continued to be so.
Okay.
when we are in a highly pressed and anxious culture, when the children's teeth are set on edge and empathy is reduced, the endurance of the relationship, it doesn't become as primary. And so if I'm hurt or whatever or disagree, I just walk. It's different than trying to retain the relationship and try to better understand where people are coming from.
What helps us produce that kind of organizational and cultural environment in which that empathy can develop and dependency on each other grows so that that kind of relationship is possible?
There also might be some ideas here as well. I believe that truth-telling and modeling empathic behavior, that is, being as empathic as we can be, trying to foster ways to reduce denial, to openly address conflict, that those are, you know, some ways that we begin to work at it ever so slowly.
Bruce, I remember your story of the council meeting that the pastor asked people to disclose their present feelings to him. And maybe the best use tonight would be to do that. But I want to check out my perception of it. It seems to me that that small churches seem to be the place where the people who are spun off by the centrifuge of some successful church somewhere wind up. Mm. It seems to me that we have an inordinate number of people with problems in the smaller churches. Why are they in the big churches too? And is my ministry a ministry in a small church of healing with psychoneurotic people? You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so, but I don't. You're really thinking that they leave the large. No, I see. I would probably disagree with that. I would assume that they're there, and they're just silent, or they're saying it in different ways. The gift that you've got is that you're seeing it.
No,
the people are not hiding their distress. I think that's a wonderful gift. I mean, terrifying and difficult, but see, larger organizations suppress things, and so people just get in line and privately pain sometimes. Smaller organizations, the pain can rise. People gift the organization with the pain without seeing it that way. It's our opportunity to embrace the pain, but to continue to be resourced with our own pain. I don't know.
Go ahead, just break in.
It seems to me that sometimes the pastor who is not of the community is, you know, dropped into a small community, becomes the scapegoat, you know, the one that's responsible for everything. And that some people in the small church have more invested in perpetuating the system just as it is than in anything of change that resembles change.
But you can avoid that by, I mean, if the small church is an extension of a large family system, and it's a folly à deux, that it's a vicious game, but everyone sort of plays it because that's what it's about. If the pastor comes in and learns how to play that game and accepts the game, then the pastor will work. It's when you try and disrupt the game and won't play it that you get extruded. But the question is, what's the alternative? I mean, besides playing the game and getting extruded.
That's a good question.
And why do you have to live in an unhealthy way just to,
Because then you get scapegoated.
Yeah, I know. I don't
but those aren't
the
only two alternatives.
But that's what I'm asking. Yeah. How do you avoid those two alternatives?
Right. Right. And I suppose I could make a lot of money if I really knew. But it seems to me that a start is to to be a truth teller way before one gets so angry that the truth comes out in unempathic ways. Mm-hmm. I can not participate in a way of doing things. At the same time, as I don't angrily seek to change the way that it's done, I can, in fact, simply, although obviously I'm saying an ideal state here that I couldn't possibly do, you know, well, but it's just a beginning struggle. I can be simply as I am, whose I am, who I am, and just sort of be that who I am, without necessarily demanding that other people change, and without necessarily getting too colluded into the way that people are. What that allows me to do is begin to understand some of the roots. You've heard the Ed White story, have you? It's an Auburn Institute fellow, I think. This is Parrish. This is supposedly a true story. It's so outrageous it can't be true, but it sounds wonderful, so it must be true. Old Parrish, he went in, he was a supply, came in, and it's a small parish, but there was enough for about half full. Have you heard the story? And they came in, and he preached, well, up to the sermon, everybody was on one side of the church. And then he stopped the sermon, or the sermon was over, and then they had the collection, everybody moved to the other side. And this happened a couple of times, and they couldn't figure, what in the world, you know? And the first thing is, well, this is ridiculous, I'm going to try to change, you know, their behavior, or I'm going to try to do something. Then he just sort of, in empathy, before he got too angry about it, before he thought it was too strange, you know, he just asked, what does this mean? Well, what it means, what it meant, apparently, was that in the old days, there was a wood-burning stove. And when people came into the church, it was cold. So everybody went to the side where the wood-burning stove was. And then by the time the sermon was done, it was too hot. So they moved over. Now, this was a liturgical act. Which somebody coming in says, this is nuts, I want to change this. Everybody, you know, I'm going to make a rule. Everybody comes in, we're going to sit all over the place. See, now that's an unnecessary intervention. But not to intervene doesn't mean you're colluding with the system. It just means that you're waiting to work to find out what this means. And when you find out what it means, you find that out on the basis of the fact that you've got a truth teller or two in the congregation who tells you. And then you can aid the truth telling by sort of letting people think about whether they still want to do that, or somehow they'd like to bless it. I mean, when you talk about stuff this way, it becomes pretty idealistic, because we're talking about a principle apart from actually doing it or being in the midst of it. So it is kind of that way. But fundamentally, to me, it's being able to truth tell in the context of relationships that have empathy, and not to feel like you've got to sort of go along with the system and not be a truth teller. But at the same time, you're going to be doing that well before one gets to the point that one's so angry or anxious that one's lost empathy. Because once the empathy's been lost, there's no longer a relationship in the context of which to tell the truth in a helpful way.
But they don't sit around waiting for you to make this decision. There's an awful lot of energy that goes into hooking you into the game. And they're very good at finding where you're vulnerable. Mm-hmm. And the only way I see myself ever succeeding in resisting that, or anyone else, is that there's someone that is father confessor that's not in the midst of it, that can sit down and talk to, mm-hmm. and they sort of keep me straight. Now, how many of us have a person like that?
I help everyone.
Yeah, but where do you get them? I mean, is it true that we all have a person like that?
I help everyone. The capacity to have in one's life an outside agent. See, this is a little bit what you just won't have to come to Thursday morning, you know. The question is, if the unit of health is not the individual but a group, then part of my health responsibility for myself is to place as much as I can into my environment people who can be for me in certain ways that I need for my own health. And also conversely, to be allowed by other people, to be allowed to let myself be placed in other people's things. There's a therapist by the name of J.L. Marino that did psychodrama that talked a lot about the social atom. That's where I first got the idea a little bit that the unit of health is a group, not an individual. And the whole thing is, since you can't reduce yourself to an individual, you reduce yourself to the social atom. That is, what functions you need in your life in order to remain healthy. If they're not there, it's part of our responsibility, I think, to see if we can place into our lives people who can provide certain functions for our health. So the idea of having a pastor confessor, or an outside agent, or an organizational consultant, or a spiritual director, or any one of a number of combinations of that and more, seems to me would be totally crucial. I have, for instance, I found that I could not function sanely with only a support system within the LCMS. I sort of thought I could build one. So I found a group of psychologists, mostly Roman Catholic, and we meet every couple of weeks, minimum once a month. That keeps me a little sane because I can test some things. It's just very important for me to do that for myself. So to put into your system what you need in order to retain as much health as possible is part of our own, I think, capacity to develop personal responsibility for our health. So I applaud that way of thinking about it. I can't imagine going into a system without some help, especially one that's difficult or conflicted. I can't imagine staying in my position without having outside consultants and helpers with me. I just get overwhelmed. Does that help at all with what you... I do tend to blather on, and that's why I try to work from a manuscript when I present.
I came from a small church, my first parish, and it was a two-point parish. And I told the congregation, the council meeting, where my mileage was going. And in that process, I lived next to one church and traveled to do worship service at the other church, two on Sunday. And wrote down mileage to the second church for the mileage on that Sunday was to do the service. In being honest with them, they became irate that I was charging them for mileage to go to that church service. And by the end of the 3 years, they were telling me that they were sorry they'd ever put the parsonage next to the other church. They should have put it halfway between. Every other pastor up until that time, which I didn't know, had done mileage in such a way that it never became an issue that they were paying the mileage to go out to that church. So honesty caused me a big problem. And yet it was the only way I thought I was doing something, good. Let's be honest. Let's, be open about this. Yeah. And it caused a heap of problems.
Yeah. Partially because there'd been some collusion and denial previously. Because you're not starting with a beginning process.
Right.
You're starting with something in which people, so you're not only raising the issue for yourself, but you're also sort of causing some wondering about what the precedent has been and all that kind of business. And see, I think that one of the things that, and I'm not sure this helpful way to go at it, but it is the sort of the way that I try to think about it a little bit, or I have thought about it. I think it's very hard in our culture for a pastor in a parish to articulate in a positive way her or his needs from the parish without some outside help to do so, because our culture tends to label that as self-serving, and selfishness or personal need tends to be undervalued. That's why I think the organizational issues are so important, that we have bishops and district presidents and circuit counselors and cluster deans and other kinds of folks who can articulate the needs of the worker on behalf of the need, on behalf of the individual worker. So we're not just our own articulators of our needs, that we've got some organizational help to do that. I think that if I were in a different vocation, I would think of myself as a union organizer, because it does have to do with how it is that we can get clusters of people who can articulate the reasonable personal needs of church workers and not run the organization on the backs of them, which is sometimes what we do. Please, just...
How could one present these four unnamed pressures to a group of leaders like a council without coming across as self-serving?
I have no idea. I don't think... I really believe in my heart that the connection of empathy and understanding is the key to any kind of presentation. That if the if stuff is used to clobber people in some way, regardless of how nicely it's presented or how theologically correct it is, it becomes problematic. People pick up the barb and are responding to the barb. If there is a let's try to understand things together sort of approach, before it goes too far down the road, that is, the earlier intervention, the more truth-telling that occurs in small units, I think the better off people are going to be. I think in trying to institute some small stuff makes lots of sense to me. I think that if we could open many task meetings with just a few minutes of reflection on how we are and what's going on, I think that sets a different kind of tone. I think if we take some time with ourselves before we go to task, I think attention to process and where people are, even in the midst of the task, I think those sorts of things would tend to speak to these sorts of issues more.
You know, one of the things I think that I've learned in listening to some clergy talk to me about needs might address part of this problem, and that is if we developed a method of continuing education that brought clergy and laity from the same parish to the same event. So, for example, if the pastor and one or two persons from his or her parish were here today, you would have with you someone who could say to other members of the parish, this is what is happening. The way we've structured education is whatever you learn as clergy, you have to go back and sell to the laity. Mm-hmm. And that's
a very good point.
That's a screwy way of helping the congregation to grow. So that I think that's one of the things that we're trying to work at in the process of Lens. We tried it for this conference by encouraging some of you to bring lay people to see how it would work. If we can move it on for the next one, we're going to try and get more lay people here. But it would be one way to speed up that process.
Well, I turn 10 invitations that I try not to turn down are any invitations that involve congregational leadership. Because it's to speak to the congregational leadership that also has the tone of how professional church workers are cared for. And if we can get the very thing that you're talking about, I think is just sort of underlining that. People can begin to think, well, now, how are we treating people? I mean, really, how are we treating people? And to be able to, if people follow leaders on the basis of behavior, not on the basis of their words. So congregations come together and will be inviting places, not on the basis of what they proclaim, if what they proclaim is contrary to how they're behaving. So that's what I call either theo or psychobabble, you know, which is we just sort of we put a theological subject and a theological verb and a couple of theological prepositions together, and we're talking about something. But if our behavior isn't congruent with that, obviously it's a trouble, and people will respond to behavior more than they will to our words. So the shifting has to do with the behavioral part of you, not the verbal part of you, it seems like to me, and that has to do with setting a hospitable tone in which people are able to be received in some way. And I suppose it might work 20% of the time. I mean, I think Timothy is right that nothing changes everything.
Lean it back here. Okay.
What you said over in your lecture about congruity made a lot of sense to me, because if you are in a position of being incongruous and the disease has started, and then you come to the congregation or the church council expressing your need will not be clear. It will not make sense, perhaps, to the council, and then they will be responding to the way your need is presented. Everyone in a congregation has needs, and if you are expressing a genuine need, most people will listen. You could have the conflict of need, and then you need to talk about that.
Yes.
Resolve it.
Right. Not everybody's needs are going to get satisfied, but the culture is that people can bring to the table what they're thinking and feeling. And so we talk, we want, you know, we feel, and we trust to bring it to the table and allow things to be embraced. Not always satisfied, but embraced.
My question has to do with calling of pastors and church workers and our wanting to measure their competence in various areas, and typically going through everything from preaching to teaching to relational skills and so forth. But considering that, considering how important it is that the individual is a whole person emotionally and mentally, I'm wondering how we can go about determining that with a little bit more perception. I mean, whether this person is, it has to do with self-esteem or brokenness in his or her past or ego and all these other kinds of things that enter in quite strongly into a person's ministry, and so often problems in the parish have less to do with a person's pastoral competence than it has to do with some of these other emotional and mental difficulties that get acted out in different ways. But I don't think we're very good at measuring that. That's really my question.
I agree. I don't think we are.
How do we do that?
I don't know. It's just an issue. I would rather have as my pastor someone who is clearly wounded with whom I can identify. So it's not is a person wounded or not. We're all wounded, some more than others. But I think there's no wound that is in that keeps people from being workers in the church or clergy that I know of. It's a question of what we deal with, how we approach the wound and the wounding, not whether or not there is some. So if a person is able to tell the truth about their own wounds, I rejoice. And that's fine. I think the problem, the most problem that we have is people who either don't know that they're wounded and are, and behaving as if they're not, and in the process wounding everybody else so that they become like them. Or people who are, you know, just that whole business of denial or whatever. I'm not particularly fond of the preloading. You know, who wrote this book on, it's an Auburn book on selection for ministry in the crisis, and he talks about front loaders, mid loaders, and end loaders and their evaluation of people. And the Missouri Synod doesn't have a load at all. At that point, I think the ELCA was an end loader or something. Anyway, you do all this testing of people somewhere along the line, before candidacy, during candidacy, after candidacy. There's not a lot of evidence that that's what that does. At best, however, what it could do is open up some of the talking about the woundedness and letting people, you know, become more forthcoming about it. So my answer to your question, I think, is I don't know that we have good measures, but my sense of things is that if people can put on the table some of their history and their woundedness and whatever, and we can sort of work together with that, then we're okay. It's when people don't know their wounds and then inflict them on others that we begin to run into trouble.
Earlier tonight, you made a brief reference to clergy relating to one another as competitors rather than colleagues. And what got me thinking about that was John's story about the pastors who would debate very vigorously and you know, verbalize views that were in sharp contrast, and yet, having done that, would still be friends and shake hands, and there wasn't the threat of some sort of personal insult or ridicule or rejection. There was mutual respect and love and empathy, I suspect, which allowed a freedom of expression that could tolerate sharp differences. And I think maybe that's a good way of understanding collegiality. But I'd like to hear you speak more on pastors as competitors, because that kind of rang a bell for me.
But I like what you said. That was wonderful. And so I just underline that. What do I have to fear from you is the competitor piece. That is, why do you make me anxious? I feel threatened, embarrassed, humiliated. What? Whatever it is, let's talk about it. And then find a way to connect in a more collegial and cooperative way. But it won't happen, see, if we do a little dance while there are other things that are unnamed going on. So I smile and say hello and I'm nice and whatever. But underneath, I'm afraid, have you taken 10 of my parishioners away? Or if I let you come guest preach, will they all want to go to your church and away from me? Or, you know, why not put that on the table?
Well, the extension of that is it enough just not to be jealous, but why don't we help and support each other more? Most professional groups have a review process, and it's not always healthy. But at its best, people bring cases to their colleagues and then get help, not that what did you do wrong, but how else could this have been done, or where do we do that?
If, to circle back to a point, after a while I probably just say the same thing in different ways, and I apologize for that, but I'm limited in what I know and can respond to. I think how do we do that is to put into our circle, into our social atom, people who can do that with us. I was talking after my presentation with somebody. We were talking about a zone of safety, or you know, where to get that. And I said that when I came to the LCMS, I thought that it might be a good idea that if we could somehow redeem what we have are circuits, which would be groups of 6 to 10 congregations, and somehow see if we could redeem the circuit process in order to do that. I've since abandoned that as a reasonable option. And the reason I've abandoned it is because people don't have a choice about who's in the circuit. So it's not a self-selection, it's a organizational selection. So how the organization can help is to not get miffed if people aren't using what they're set up as an organization, at least for deep things. Because if you don't select who's in your group, the safety levels of the group can be significantly compromised. And I've seen circuits change overnight with the addition of one person who just makes such a destructive difference in the group that people will no longer operate safety-wise in a safe manner. So our task then would be to create self-selection groups where this could happen, and the organization's task would be to bless those, that is to not get angry that the organization stuff is not being used, to sort of bless how we're doing that and maybe to find money in continuing education or in some other way to help support those meetings. And it probably wouldn't just be our own denominational people. It would be wherever we could find the people that would provide the sorts of support or could gather together in levels of safety that would allow us to do what we need to do in a collegial way, that's what we'd develop.
Bruce, would you say something about this? I always think that with preaching, there's a certain amount of self-revealing. Granted, even if a person just hides behind the text and just says, thus says the Lord, this is what the text is, and expounds on that, there's a certain amount of self-revelation in that to say, you're not going to get anything from me because I'm scared to death of telling you anything about myself. The other extreme, I suppose, would be the person that sort of is working on their own angst through their sermons, or their own anger through their sermons. Some of this congruency, could you relate some of that to preaching? Seems to be part of the tough work maybe of sermon preparation would be what you were saying there, where you get over some of the anger or anxiety or whatever it may be. So there is a bit of both understanding of grace, of what needs, of the truth that needs to be said, and also empathy for the parishioners.
I agree. No, I do. I think that if our task, I mean, what's the preaching task? I think part of it is to witness, not necessarily to I may want to take this back, but what I was going to say was not necessarily to overtly change people. See, what if I just in my sermonizing witness faith's relationship in my life, how faith is, how that works, how the gospel links to me, what I'm thinking about in terms of things, put it in a proclamatory mode or something. I don't know. It's different than discharging one's emotionality through sermonizing. And that is a problem. Because then, again, the words, regardless of how, of the content of the words, become charged with the emotionality that they're actually either unconsciously or consciously communicating. And people pick that up, what it is, mostly. What they do know is that it doesn't feel good. And so they, you know, crunch, but they don't know why. You know, there's not a clear identification of what it is that they're feeling badly about. You know, like I hear a sermon sometimes, and I say, why am I feeling unsettled? Or it's partially because there are other things that are coming at me through the sermon, and they're unclear, they're undiscussed, but there's an edge, or a crunch, or a hook, or something. And we all can't get rid of all that, of course, because we're all fallen creatures, you know, and this is not a perfect world. But some reflection on that for ourselves, and some working through the emotional content of our sermonizing, I think would be really helpful. But I think that's just what you said. I was just trying to build.
That's a whole different side to sermon preparation, which probably is a long process of being a little bit in touch with yourself by way of other avenues, learning about yourself.
Right. I sat through a 35-minute sermon it was orientation for our new boards and everything. And the preacher preached for 35 minutes, and I swear I didn't say a thing. I mean, it was all there. I mean, it was just, but it was not related to anything that was going on. So there wasn't any mention of the fact that there were new board members present. There wasn't anything. Just we ought to get out and preach the gospel. I mean, it was a doggonest thing. I'm leaving, and I'm unsettled. I just am unsettled because there's more there, or more that wasn't said, or something. And it's sort of that reflection upon, I covet for people a safety group from one's parish in which one gets feedback on the digestion process of sermons, for instance, where you can begin to get a flavor. See, I don't think any of this is stuff that we should do by ourselves, but you begin to get a flavor of how people are receiving not only what was said, but how it was said. And a safe place with people who will tell you if it's coming across in charged ways, but will do so in empathy. That is, you get it started early enough so that they're not angry, so it hasn't happened 73 times, and the 74th time they tell you, but then there's no empathy to it, they're just busting out about it. See, I think the whole, the completion of the feedback loop for us, so much of what we do is uncommented on. And to be able to put into our social atom places and spaces and people who can give us feedback about ourselves and what they hear and see, and especially the emotional flavor of ourselves.
Sounds to me like maybe we need to encourage Concordia Health Plan and whatever AELC uses to require therapy for all their clergy.
Frankly, the health plans are interested in decreasing.
Yeah.
not increasing it. And maybe there are other things, self-reflecting capacities, groups, being able in seminary to start. I had several spouses of seminarians tell me collectively that they thought that the seminary was a spiritual wasteland. That the shift from storytelling in their own personal faith to academic theology was more almost than their souls could bear. But if that's true, is it possible at seminary levels, for instance, to begin to get started on spiritual direction? See, not everything is a therapeutic. You know, therapy is not the everything. There are lots of things that we can do corporately and connectedly that would make just tons of sense. The thing would be that people get involved in something along those lines, and that be part of the culture. It's just sort of expected. This is kind of what we do, and it's not a hoop. It's just kind of what it is to be in ministry.
You know, what you are saying sounds terrific, and I could buy it all. And you've been sharing a lot of this with different congregations. I'm wondering if you could give us any illustrations or feedback on how these things have worked for different congregations or pastors.
Actually, I hope that within a year we'll be able to provide something that would make sense in a real way in terms of your question. We're working to develop a congregational health inventory in which we might actually be able to measure a little bit change. The feedback that I tend to get is that people find the ideas intriguing and in some small ways try to make a change toward empathy. My hope is that people don't try, that we're not trying to change the world, even the world of our own lives. Just a commitment, for instance, from this conference, maybe to make one shift in behavior for ourselves. And I get some significant feedback that happens, that people do that. You know, like who do you need in your social atom that isn't there? And a little strategy to develop that.
I've been very impressed on how so-called primitive communities depend upon their liturgy to reestablish homeostasis or deal with tensions that have to be dealt with for the community to exist. And it's my assumption that liturgy is supposed to function that way for us. Have you seen it do that? And what are the signs of a liturgy that in fact functions as a source of healing for the community?
I've participated in liturgies that have felt extremely healing to me. I confess to you that that my experience here is a very healing liturgical experience. I find what's going on here to be quite reflective and soothing and settling. But I don't know the answer to that question. But I sure would like people to work on it from the perspective that you're raising the question, which is how do we utilize some of the historic or contemporary or whatever liturgies. I mean, what to engage us in healing relationships.
Our occasional services book has a service of the word for healing that we've adapted in my church to use as the main worship service once every 3 months. And it feels like so little, but people really appreciate it. Mm-hmm. Have that opportunity, and we've been doing that.
I once heard a Presbyterian lecture to a group of Lutheran clergy saying to them that the liturgical worship service we have is the best healing document that exists if we only knew what was going on and used it correctly.
Did he tell you what correctly meant?
Aware of what's going on. Being conscious of what's happening at that process. But I guess you get so used to it.
Take it for granted.
Yeah, you take it for granted. You don't come prepared for it. And you aren't living the reality of what it says.
And why you do the things you do week after week. You have to explain or tell stories about them so that they come to life again.
You know, when I was a kid, I remember when the LBW was first introduced in my home congregation.
That makes us all feel good.
Yeah. I got news for you. I'm still a kid. But anyway, I remember our two pastors spending a tremendous amount of time and energy over a period of about 6 months, introducing that liturgy and explaining it in infinite detail, and the purpose behind it, the value of it. And even for me, as whatever I was, a 10, 12-year-old kid, it was helpful. And it was kind of interesting. You know, maybe we need to do that again. We're dealing with a whole new generation of parishioners. Maybe we need to do that again.
How many people still use LBW?
Still use it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Regularly, all the time?
Yeah. But it's not the point of using the LBW. But it's the point of understanding the elements within it so that when you do use it in revised ways, they still understand what's going on. And I think, Mark, your point is well taken. As we increase the number of persons who are joining Lutheran Church who do not have Lutheran tradition, they're not aware of everything, that all of the freight that goes with it that helps them understand. And that's an educational experience and process that takes a period of time. It can be done in varieties of ways and forms.
And at the risk of tying it and making it simply another point of mine or something like that, what are we saying? We're saying that the key would be to develop empathy with the liturgy. That is, what could be more outer piety than to do things that are not understood just to do them, because we do them. So the whole business of education and sort of narration has to do with building of empathy and relationship and meaning to what's being done. And the assumption of simply we go through something because it's there without the constant storytelling related to what it means is, I think loses the empathic thread in the liturgy. I mean, I would like actually a narrator from time to time, myself, who could. Our parish tends to be one that we do something different every week. It's driving me a little on the nutty side because I tend to be more of a traditionalist myself. But even if we do that, at least furnish me a narrator who tells me stories about why we're doing it, and not just content. Not just this is the theology. Give me a story. Tell me why. Tell me something that allows me to connect in an emotional way, empathic way, to what's happening. I really like the storytelling idea that you said.
Mm-hmm. I just say, and I do think this was the very first way people, you know, were brought into the church by this means or that. When they prayed, they said this, and this is why. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's just telling the story of church history and saying, you know, you're connected with all your brothers and sisters from that day forward. Yeah. You know, when it's a Reformation or Acts, as Dr. Long was speaking to. You know, I've kind of tentatively raised my hand here for a while because I don't know, I'm so tired if I can even articulate this. Right. I'm in a small rural church, and it's a great church, and full of life and vitality, but it's gone through some changes. And I've got a major symptom bearer in my congregation who's driving me up a wall. And she's very much she loves her church, and yet it's changed, and I think she's just mad as heck about it. And the things she makes so much trouble and angst for all of us about, it's kind of sick and unhealthy, but in a way, if you look at the symptom there, you know, it's kind of a collective repository of all the changes. And it's hard for us, or for me, to get her to talk about her inner reality. Her husband's got cancer. That's another big thing, you see. And as the couple last few years have worn on, it's gotten worse and worse to the point that it bored me. She and her angst, I think, has a kind of cast a pall on the rest of the board members, because I try to start my meetings out, well, how'd your day go? How's it going for you? And see, I don't know, and you can't lead a horse to water, but they won't drink. And I'm not sure there is an answer, but it's a struggle for me pastorally as her pastor, because I do feel for her, And yet at times she drives me and everyone else crazy, and it's sort of a hindrance to ministry.
Is it too far down the road, or are there still significant empathic links?
There aren't as many as there used to be. I used to be able to, she'd come in and start, you know, ragging on me, and I'd say, well, yeah, okay, and then she'd sit down. I said, well, how's it going with Bob? Well, now I can't even get that far with her. And I don't know why that is.
Yeah, sometimes it's the best of all of what we do isn't useful. That's why it's only the only thing that we have control over is our capacity to continue to be who we are.
Yeah.
I do believe, however, that more discussion in the context of empathy around how people's behavior affects people.
Yeah.
So if I'm not lost, sort of in the anger or something like that, I might raise something related to, you know, when you come in and do that thing, whatever it is, you know, in the midst of her doing it, that makes me feel tense, unhappy, or whatever, and makes it harder to relate effectively to you. And I really want to work on that, because I don't want it to be that way. Can we? It's too far down the road, and it's blame.
Yeah, I know.
But truth-telling beforehand is to raise the consciousness of the community that everybody's got some responsibility for how their behavior, what their behavior causes in the insides of others. And the only way that we know about it is if people are willing, in a safe context, to tell us about it. And that's the emergence of the new collegial community, at least from my point of view, where people are actually able to talk about their effect on each other and not lose empathy.
That's hard in my community, because we don't reveal a whole lot. You live in a small town, because somebody might use it against you later.
Yep.
So there's a lot of secrecy in a sense.
And it's not safe.
Yeah.
That's right.
It's not safe.
One of the things I was once told by a therapist was that sometimes a healing community, the best we can do is not to try and fix it, but to be a safe place for the person to completely finish their breaking down process. That they have to break down, and we need to let them do it, not fix it.
Yep. We want to be receivers. As we are received, in a spirit of empathy, we treat symptom bearers as gifts. Not easy to do, you know. But there is safety that the gift that the communication is made means that there's still some hope for the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that people have simply shut down and are not doing anything at all with each other. She's still at something.
Yeah.
So there's something there that's crucial for her. So a little bit of exploration of it might be intriguing.